this coming Saturday morning, about 50 children of our parish will be making their first confession, a group that's very largely from the Spanish-speaking portion of our parish. So in these few weeks prior to that, we have a little proximate preparation for the children, a little last preparation to get them ready. I always like to give the children one talk before confession that mostly is about the nuts and bolts of what they need to expect, what they have to be prepared to do, what the sequence of events is going to be so that they're prepared for it. And we ask for a couple of volunteers and give them made-up sins to make a little demonstration confession so that people can get in their minds how this is going to look. But before we get to the nuts and bolts part, you know, children always love to ask why. And when you answer that question that is put to you by a child, why, very often they have a second why to go one step back from the first explanation. So before we get to the nuts and bolts, I always like to anticipate that kind of question by starting out and talking about why we're doing all this, why we have the sacrament of reconciliation to begin with. And I do that by reminding the children, first of all, that God has made himself known to us as the Holy Trinity, one God in three divine persons. So even before creation, when only God existed, there was something going on. God was doing something, if you will. From all eternity, God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit has lived in a communion of love, with love being exchanged among those three divine persons. God then created us in his own image, likewise to live in a communion of love with him and with others like ourselves in this world. God in his goodness wants us to live in that communion with him and with the saints forever in glory. But to do that, we have to know that language. We have to be ready for that life of loving God and loving others. That's what we're doing here on earth, learning to love God and love others as we should, so that we're ready to do that for eternity. And when we don't love God or others as we should, that's what we call a sin. And when we do that, then we've got to ask God's forgiveness, so that we're restored to his friendship and given new strength to love God and others as we should, so that we are ready to do that forever. I think I'm on pretty sound theological ground in giving that explanation to the children. And I would justify it by pointing to the gospel of today's Mass, where the Lord gives us the two great commandments of the new law. Love God above all things with your whole heart and mind and soul and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. That really all of the more particular commandments that we have are specifications of these two great commandments. They only tell us what things are necessary to do or essential to avoid if we're going to love God and others with our whole heart and as ourselves. I think that's a very good way to describe sin, failure to love God or love others as we should. There's only one little pitfall in it. Somebody hearing that description, a sin is a failure to love God or others as we should, might have the impression, that in order to commit sin, one has to formulate a hatred for God or others that you are acting on. You might say, well, Monsignor, I got great news for you. I just have no hatred whatsoever for God. I never want to offend him, and the truth of the matter is, I never think of him at all. So it's clear that my life is free from sin. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. And it should be evident in the words of the gospel themselves. You shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. That's not just avoid formulating hatred and contempt for God. It is do something active. Sometimes when I'm talking to the children about the obligation to pray, I use the human parallel. It's always helpful, I think. Human parallels are always very helpful. I said, imagine that you get up in the morning and say not a word to your mother. You eat your breakfast, not a word, not thanking her for preparing your breakfast, nothing. You go off to school without a word. You come back and don't say a word to her. The rest of the afternoon and evening while you're eating dinner, not a word. You go to bed in silence. You could say, I didn't say a cross word to my mother all day. But what's her impression? That you were perfectly polite to her? No. She'd say, what's wrong? Do you hate me? Well, I suppose you do hate me. Why do you hate me today? That you haven't said a word to me. So that's a way to think about our obligation to pray. The avoiding blasphemy is not sufficient. We are to have an active love of God. So, the moral teaching of the church is all about specifying those things that we must do in order to manifest a minimal love of God, and those things that must be avoided because he forbids them, as we know, either through natural law or through revelation. And loving God includes obedience to what he asks. So that is an important part of loving God above all things. And likewise, with regard to our neighbor, indifference is not enough. The second great commandment is more than that. But that is not, obviously, the whole story of loving God above all things with our whole heart and soul and mind and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. I think that this is the year coming after the first of the year when we'll have the Winter Olympics again. I think it's the even years that are off years for our elections. The Winter Olympics. I don't know if you ever watched the Winter Olympics. Back in the old days, you know, everybody watched the Olympics. It was a very, very big deal. And so when I was a kid, I used to watch the Olympics, of course. And they would have figure skating. And they would always say, after the compulsories, this skater was in first place or in third place in the standings, whatever. And so they referred to these mysterious compulsories. And you never saw those on TV. But one year, when they were showing the Olympics, they explained what those were. And I think I have this right. I don't really have a footnote on this, but I believe this is true. That in the compulsories in figure skating, the skaters have to inscribe with their skates as precisely as possible certain required figures. Like, I suppose, a figure eight, a circle, I don't know, a parabola, some compulsory figures to show that they can control themselves very precisely on their skates. They never show that on TV. It's not really great entertainment. What we see on TV is the artistry of what they can do with their creativity in, you know, flying on ice, dancing on ice. So my proposal is, this is a little bit like the Christian life. Those things that the love of God and love of neighbor absolutely requires us to do or to avoid, those are the compulsories of the Christian life. But they're not really the most interesting part of the Christian life, nor the most beautiful. What is most interesting and most beautiful are the ways in which each soul can take to heart these two great commandments and live them in a unique way according to the circumstances, the gifts, the limitations, the personality that each person has been given by the Creator. We're going to celebrate that this week when we come to the great solemnity of All the Saints. You know, there are certain, let's say, organizations in human experience where the object is to create clones, if you will, a uniform product where one looks as much like the last as possible. There's sort of an ideal model, and you try to make each person come out looking exactly like that. This is not the Catholic faith. In our faith, in our experience, there is an unspeakable variety and diversity of holiness in the different ways that these commandments can be lived out. You know, some of our saints have been among the brightest people who have ever walked the face of the earth. St. Thomas Aquinas always comes to mind. Edith Stein, St. Teresa Benedicta in the last century would be a plausible candidate. But others of our saints were some of the simplest people that have ever lived. St. John Vianney was famously found it difficult to get through the seminary. Solanus Casey, the Capuchin priest originally from Wisconsin, who is going to be canonized next month. He was ordained as a simplex priest. We don't do that anymore, but a man was ordained to say Mass, but it was thought he didn't understand theology well enough to be allowed to preach or hear confessions. That was how Solanus Casey was ordained as a simplex, but became a beacon of holiness, working as a doorkeeper in the Capuchin Friary in Detroit for many, many years with countless answered prayers on behalf of those who came to him. Some of our saints have been royalty. St. Bridget of Sweden, St. Henry, the King of Bavaria and Holy Roman Emperor, and others have been, at the margins of society, like that great Dominican whose father was not known, who was of mixed Spanish and African heritage, whose name is escaping me at the moment. But a tremendous variety of who the saints were. You know, men and women, young and old, rich and poor. Some who built tremendous structures of charity and education. Some who died as martyrs, seemingly completely rejected and failures in this world. But those two great commandments were at the root of everything that they did and everything that they were. So that's the other side, the more surprising and fascinating and beautiful side of the Christian life. The Lord tells us what must be done and what must be avoided to save us from very bad mistakes, to keep us from the sadness that he does not want for us, and from self-destruction. But these two great commandments open to us an almost infinite variety of goodness and holiness. So today, as we celebrate the Eucharist, we thank the Lord for these two great commandments that preserve us from tragedy and which open for us a tremendous diversity of holiness and fruitfulness. We ask the Lord to help us see how he wants these two commandments to be lived more deeply, more completely, more fruitfully in our own lives.